Hello and welcome to the Intrafish Podcast, where we bring you the week's most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Editor Drew Cherry, joined today by Executive Editor John Fiorillo. Yes, it is the week's most interesting seafood news. However, skipped a week, we have a good excuse. We were at the North Atlantic Seafood Forum in Bergen and the Boston Seafood Show this past week. Now, the North Atlantic Seafood Forum, we'll revisit that next week, and we'll do a wrap-up of that because there's some specific issues that we want to hit on and discuss in that episode. But this week, myself and John are going to talk about the Boston Seafood Show, known as Seafood Expo North America. It happens every year around this time, and as you can hear, I brought back a cold, just like I do every single year. So, in addition to lots of great news and great story ideas and picking up some good rumblings from around the industry, also have a pretty nasty cough and a runny nose. So, there you go, listener, more than you probably need. So, John, I thought today we'd start off with the Intrafish Seafood Leadership event. Now, we held this on March 11th, which is only Monday. It feels like a week ago. But I think that sets the stage really well because we hit on a lot of the key themes that were prevalent kind of throughout the show. Now, this is a great event. We had two panels and had all kinds of top executives joining us. The main goal of the event was, can we bring these people together? Can we do some debate and discussion about how to restart seafood consumption? So panel one, that included Joe Bundrant. He's the CEO of Trident Seafoods. It included Kim Gorton, the CEO of Slade Gorton. It included Anna Vistendahl. She's the global head seafood of DNB. Also included Jok van de Pit. She's the CEO of Pittman Seafoods. And Paul Dewar. He's the CEO of Highliner Foods. You know, I started off with a tough question. I went ahead and dove right in and started asking about China. I opened and said, hey, what went wrong? So, John, tell me what the reaction was. Let's talk about how they handled it.
Well, okay, yeah. I think they handled it pretty well, given that there were people on the panel with probably fairly opposing views on it. I'm thinking of Joe Bundrant on the one side, who has been part of the group championing tighter controls on imports of Chinese seafood. And I'm thinking of Kim Gorton, for example, on the other side, that while recognizing the challenges with China, part of what she said was, you know, this throws out the good actors with the bad actors. And I think that's a valid point. So, I thought they dove into it pretty deeply. I was happy to see that. And I think, I don't think we solved any problems. You know, we still have the forced labor problem. We still have the geopolitical problem with Russia, and they're all affecting this supply chain. In fact, I mean, you walk away and you think, holy moly, the entire whitefish supply chain is being redone, you know, right before our eyes. Everything that we took for granted for years, you know, fish go to China, get processed, come back, all those things we took for granted have changed, and changed in a very short period of time. So it's, you know, it takes a while for an industry to adjust to that, but it will, and it already is. And I thought that part was really interesting. They were fairly frank about their feelings and where things were headed.
You know, I found an interesting contrast when it came to the idea of auditing in China, and that was really what jumped out. And it wasn't just this panel. I heard it several times over the past week when I would ask folks about Chinese transparency, how to ensure that your supplier is doing the right thing. And, you know, you arrive at this place of companies saying, well, we have auditors, but when you press them on whether or not they can trust the auditors, there's a pause. And I think there's an issue here that the industry is going to really need to solve, which is, if you're going to go through the trouble of having auditors, then you really better believe that those auditors are actually doing their job. And I just find it very difficult to imagine putting an auditor in China in the position of pointing out labor issues on a factory floor of a company that's partially state-owned. I really can't see how that would end up with a result that could be objective or in any way considered third party. So I think the industry, you could see that something that there's a recognition that that's going to be a challenge for them to wrestle with. And I thought that was a really kind of one really interesting takeaway, is that nobody seemed to really have a response to that. Now, some people have people on the ground, you know, and Trident was talking about how they had boots on the ground, and those that didn't were saying, hey, we need to get people on the ground to watch what happens with that fish as it goes by, as it's processed, having your own staff member there.
Yeah, Kim Gorton made a, you know, really strong point about that I agree. I think they thought they could depend on these audits, and maybe companies thought they really could, or enjoyed the fact that they didn't have to put boots on the ground necessarily themselves. But what Kim was saying is, you know, the companies are probably going to have to do exactly what you just said, get in there. And even that, I don't know that it'll, you know, like the forced labor issue, I don't know that it'll make any difference with the forced labor issue. I mean, clearly there's a list of processors that have been connected to, you know, forced labor by the Outlaw Ocean Project. I mean, the starting point is, if you can, just stop doing business with them. And, you know, we've seen many companies already pursue that road. So, and you know, there's a bigger picture about what do we do with this processing capacity that we've relied on China for all these years? You know, you talked a second ago about bringing it ashore or closer to home, so to speak. What's that look like? Is that at all possible? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But the one thing that will come of all this is the transparency issue in this supply chain going through China has to get fixed. It just absolutely has to get fixed, or else, you know, we really can't operate there like we have been.
Well, it was an interesting thing heard at the show, and the Regal Springs CEO, I did an interview with him, and we were talking about their tilapia production on the one hand, but the interview kind of steered in a different direction, just happened to, because we were just talking about these issues, and he said, oh, well, many whitefish executives have come up and approached Regal Springs as a potential place to process their whitefish, in particular in their Mexico operations where they have excess capacity. And so that was kind of in the wind as well, wasn't it? Kind of what different areas might emerge as the new China, maybe Mexico, maybe other parts of Latin America, Vietnam, what might these places be? But you're right. I think there's a lot of thinking to be done about that. And it was really interesting to hear the panelists' thoughts on that. Now, let's talk a little bit, John, about prices and about inflation. You know, we heard from the two different panels, kind of two different sides of the issue. And while there's the input inflation, fuel, packaging, etc., there's also on the downstream side, selling to the retailer, to the processor. Anna Wissendahl did talk about the salmon sector. She really sees no signs that there's going to be any relief on the horizon for farm salmon prices, and nobody else out there is predicting any different. So what were some of the things in panel two that kind of caught your ear about what companies could do to offset or work with those high prices and still provide a value to consumers that they'll want to purchase?
I think what I heard was And it kind of goes to what you're saying, but I'm going to divert it just a hair, is that as far as seafood is being marketed today, we are at a very pivotal point. And what I mean by that is all our marketing at retail in particular has been geared towards the boomer generation, for lack of a better description. But the older consumers who have been supporting the category for decades, they're great consumers. Unfortunately, they buy most of the seafood. The problem now is the famous millennials and the Gen X's and the Gen Z's. Those people, those consumer groups dropped off significantly after COVID. And I heard a lot of the panelists talking about how are we going to talk to these newer consumers? We can't do it the way we've been doing it. They're on TikTok, they're on all these things that a lot of seafood companies just don't have a great deal of experience with. And so I see that as kind of, the main thing that I got out of that panel. And that, we published a story today about it, and it goes into depth about, what some of the options are and how we might do this. But it's going to have to be done on a broad schedule by or broad base by everybody. But it's important because if we don't recruit these consumers and do it pretty well, pretty quickly, I'm afraid some of the kind of bad numbers we've been seeing at retail could linger, so.
Well, ironically, one of the things that seem to be helping seafood sales, or as you just mentioned, is one of the things that is giving a boost is TikTok. And this today, the House of Representatives in the U.S. just passed a or moved forward a bill to ban TikTok, which probably won't happen. But anyway, it's interesting. It's a controversial app, and yet it seems like it really is something that the seafood industry needs to come to grips with. Mike Kilgore, who is a seafood buyer at Whole Foods, he mentioned a couple things that really showed a big boost in their sales. And one of them was there was a, I guess, a caviar. Some influencer had posted something on caviar. It took off, was retweeted or whatever it is on TikTok that you do, liked, I don't know. But he said it led to an immediate boost in caviar sales. And I just think that's fascinating. I still think the industry doesn't quite understand how to utilize all these things. I certainly don't, so I'm not sitting here saying that, wagging my finger. I think it is something though that clearly, when you get it right, it's working. The other thing I thought was really interesting is you mentioned the article that you wrote today, John, and we kind of highlighted these marketing ideas that we're talking about. But Teresa Lowe, she's the chief marketing officer at Acme Smokefish, the largest smokefish producer in the United States. She had really interesting thoughts on it as well. She has a background in different companies. I believe it's Hershey's and some beverage companies, major companies. And it was clear that the level of sophistication in seafood is lagging or is so low compared to other areas. And both she and Tim Noonan of Cargill, I thought, really had interesting things to say about how kind of how marketing functions in terms of reaching the consumer and the different ways that that can be done effectively. And Teresa noted new product development, and Tim did as well, and just kind of the move towards snacking. I thought that was kind of interesting. You don't think of seafood being kind of in front of any trends. You always think of seafood kind of following. But what was interesting is sushi is one that they were pointing out is really a very, very unique category that seafood plays really, really well in. And I thought that was it was kind of interesting that maybe the industry can sort of pat itself on the back a little bit or leverage some of the success it's had with sushi.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, Tim Noonan also pointed out that Cargill does really extensive research, and one of the findings of some recent research they did is 1/3 of diners are eating alone these days. And 1 in 7 meals consumed is heat and eat. So, you know, let's think about that a second. So that says consumers don't want to handle seafood, don't want to necessarily cook it and, you know, make a dinner. They want it as a component of something that they can just heat and eat, or it's convenient. And obviously sushi fits all the bill there. You just grab it and start eating it. But I think Tim's point is a really important one, because this trend has been strengthening for a long, long time. And, you know, the idea that, you know, you bring home a bunch of salmon for the family and cook it, yes, that still happens, but less and less. And that, again, goes to the changing profile of our consumers and how we need to figure out ways to talk to these consumers who are consuming our product differently, you know, than, I mean, this is why we all lament the fresh seafood case. You know, you got a bunch of raw seafood stacked, and I mean, I have no problem with it, but, you know, younger consumers probably look at it and go, what the heck?
One of the topics too was shrimp, which we know has been in the doldrums with low prices and low sales. We had on our panel as well, the second panel, we had Gabriel Luna. He's a co-founder of the Global Shrimp Council. I thought he had some interesting ideas. He was, you know, I think he was optimistic, and he sort of shrugged off your notion that this has been tried many times before. And, you know, you asked, hey, what would be different this time around? And it seemed like he had some different ideas that looked a little bit more maybe consumer focused than some of the past campaigns. I don't know. Did you get any sense that there would be anything new or fresh from the new Global Shrimp Council that we haven't seen before?
Well, new and fresh is just the energy that's, you know, kind of pumped into this whole initiative in a very short period of time. I mean, they basically developed the idea less than a year ago, really, and rolled it out. And what I got from Gabriel is that there is just a lot of buy-in on the producer side, whether it doesn't matter the country or the company to some degree. Now, they haven't been asked to pay yet, so, you know, that sometimes changes the dynamic a little bit, but the energy behind it seems to truly be there. And what that means as far as execution is a whole different matter. You know, you look at Gap, for example, the Alaska Pollock guys. I think they've done a great job of coalescing the producers together in a force. And part two of that, I think they've done a really, really good job of executing their plan. It seems well thought out, and it seems well executed. And, you know, when you look at numbers, it appears it's moving the needle as well. But that's going to be part two of this whole shrimp thing. If they have the energy, they have buy-in. Now, what's that execution going to look like? And that, it's too early to know, obviously.
You have been to many, many Boston seafood shows, John, and you tend to have a pretty good finger on the pulse of whether a show is up, down, sideways on traffic, or at least you have opinions. What do you think in general about the show? What kind of overarching themes and moods did you take away just in your time there?
Yeah, well, I've said this to several people who asked me this question, and I was really surprised by how upbeat most people seemed, given what just happened last year to the industry, as far as, you know, poor sales, trouble in Alaska, geopolitical, all the challenges that have kind of smacked us in the face last year. And I was expecting a much more somber kind of woe is us attitude, but that's not what I got. I think in people's minds, and I'm just kind of going with what I heard, 2023 for them was the bottom, and there's no way but up, as they say. So that was really the first major takeaway that I got. Now, as far as traffic, I don't know about you, Drew, but I just sense traffic was light, lighter than normal. And I don't know if I'm right. Obviously, it's just anecdotal and what I observe, but I've been to enough of these that, if I can't get down the middle aisle easily, that's a pretty good sign that the place is packed. And there weren't many moments where I didn't have that problem. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess they'll kick out some numbers at some point, but I don't know if that'll tell us anything. But it just didn't feel overwhelmingly crowded like it has in some past years. I don't know. Did you feel that, or?
I totally agree. It did seem a little lighter. Now I talked to some folks about why that might be, and I think in general, there's a lot of companies that have really pulled back their presence at Boston, and I think this goes back to COVID. And John, you remember when the show was canceled, and there was just all these questions swirling about whether or not you should go, will you go, etc. And I think it really did change a lot about how people see trade shows and conferences. I think there's a recognition that they are absolutely vital for building relationships. There's just nothing like meeting somebody in person and spending a little bit of extra time talking with them. That's not just over the screen. Now, that said, I do think a lot of companies do a lot of their business year round. They do a lot of it on Teams. They maybe do their own, go directly to their customer. So I think that's sort of a shift. Is I think that in part because the companies have gotten bigger, and in part because of COVID, I think that there is less of a need to be at Boston and see it as kind of a real make or break event for your business. Similar with Barcelona or really any other trade show, I don't think the same kinds of negotiations that had happened in the past are going on. Now that said, there is a lot of buyers there, and I know from just anecdotally from when I was doing interviews and walking around on the show floor, and people would say, "Oh, this buyer came by this morning, so I'm really happy," or they would say, "Oh, in a little bit later, buyer X is coming by, and I'm excited about that discussion." So there, of course, are important relationships that are built and important things discussed at the show. But yeah, I got the sense that maybe people are I don't want to say losing any kind of faith, because I think it's being a little more realistic about what you expect from a show and what the ROI is and who you send. So maybe it's a little bit more quality over quantity than it used to be in the past.
Yeah, I don't, in the ye old days of the show, when I first started going, if a company didn't, have a booth and show up, the immediate thought was, uh-oh, something's wrong at the company. They couldn't afford a booth this year. That's not the case anymore, obviously. And I think you hit it on the head. I think COVID gave everybody a pause. And can you imagine looking during the COVID year, not being allowed to go to one or both shows, which is what happened, and then looking at your marketing budget and seeing, you pushed all that expense to the other side of the ledger, and wow, are we spending, $100,000 on a booth and sending people to Boston, and thinking, huh, this gives me a chance to think about why we're doing that and should we continue to do it? So I think it's a little bit of a, aftershock of COVID that companies had the chance to kind of pause and reevaluate their presence at Boston. Not that they necessarily didn't want to go anymore, weren't going to go, but just to kind of right size it, a little bit. So they might lower their costs on it or something.
Yeah. Now let's talk about some of the other news that came out while we were at the show. So, or right after the show, a couple, not M&A necessarily, but divestments, more activity happening in Alaska as we get closer to the new season. And a big one this week, yesterday, as a matter of fact, was Trident Seafoods selling off one of its plants to rival Silver Bay Seafoods. Discussions about American seafoods and how it might take a different approach. There's M&A in the air, but in Alaska, there's sort of a faint whiff of desperation around it. That's my view anyway.
Yeah, I think the Alaska salmon sector in particular is, we've said this on other podcasts, it is going through a major transformation that is going, when it comes out of it, whether it's a year or two from now, it's going to look, quite a bit different than it does. And we saw the first of four plants that Trident has put up for sale in December has been sold to a rival, Silver Bay. So that's good. I suppose my sense is that maybe some of that capacity just needs to go away. But then again, I'm not in that business on a daily basis. But the American seafood one is really kind of interesting to me because this company cannot be sold. I mean, this has been going on since what, Drew, 2019? Was that when the most recent
Ooh, yeah, I think that sounds about right. 2019, yep.
And here we are, quite a few years later, and we just can't sell it. And now there seems to be, it looked like a deal was near. Now it looks like whoever was kind of going to buy it has cooled because the word is that the pollock market is kind of not great right now, and everybody's waiting to see what happens after the A season. But and there may be a whole nother effort to get new buyers back into the bidding process. So I don't know. I am really baffled by why that company is so hard to sell. I mean, we know a lot of the reasons. I'm sure the price, we never, we never heard the real price, but I'm sure it's extremely high. The company has vessels that are long in the tooth and probably need to be, well, replaced, but that's almost impossible in the United States given the Jones Act. But anyways, I don't know. It's baffling to me how long this has been going on.
Yeah, it sure is. There's also we're kind of in limbo with the sale of Ocean Beauty Seafoods as well. Their distribution and smoked salmon arm kind of stuck in a state of flux in Alaska, and it's tick-tock. It's coming up on the wild salmon season this year, so there's sure to be more activity as we get closer. The other big the big piece of news that came out just before the show that was a hot topic was High Liner Foods' investment in cod farming company Norcod. I think this really blew people away. It was just unexpected. High Liner is a long-time seafood processor focused on the consumer, focused on processing, value adding, getting it to the retailer and to the food service customer as efficiently as possible. So this was a big move, and I sat down with Paul Jewer, the CEO of High Liner, and it was quite interesting. They have not actually made an acquisition upstream, meaning quotas or any kind of biomass since the 1990s, following the collapse of Canada's Grand Banks cod population. So it's really this interesting arc from the collapse of the Grand Banks and Highlander stepping out of it, getting all out of all their vessels to here we come all these years later, decades later, and they're investing in cod farming. So you know, it's interesting. Cod farming had a big spike and then a crash, and it's kind of come back. Been a fascinating industry to watch grow and develop, but I think everybody's really now watching closely to see whether or not this is a move that more downstream suppliers will make to go ahead and buy upstream into aquaculture. Now, certainly there's a lot of companies that are vertically integrated in that way, but there's a lot that aren't. And so I think that really was that was one that was on a lot of people's lips as well.
I think it's a brilliant move. I really do. And it's interesting because this is Paul Jewer's first real kind of big move as the CEO. He's been there for a long time in the CFO position, but when Rod Hepponstall left in September, I think it was, he got to step up. And, when you change top management like that, usually the person coming in has their own ways of doing things. They've watched it for years and maybe thought, why aren't we going in this direction or why aren't we going in that direction? But Paul didn't waste any time, really. He did this, he did the cod move that you're speaking about. And I mean, if you look at, the trends in wild cod harvesting around the world, and you think about, what's that going to look like in 5 years? How are we going to control it when climate change moves things around? And basically, is that a dependable resource going forward? And anybody will tell you that any wild fishery right now, it's kind of tough to know because so many factors from regulation to climate change can affect how much, product you have. Of course, farming side is it's more stable for sure. And like you said, the farm cod sector rose, fell, and now is rising again. And it seems to be rising in a very organized, very correct way. Now, I don't want to eat my words on that because it's kind of early in the return of it, but they're starting to crank out, really good amounts of fish, So, I just love the move. I thought it was really interesting, and I thought it showed, an attitude being exhibited from Paul that might give us a clue as to how aggressive Highliner will be getting in the next few years.
Agree. Now, the other thing that was kind of hot on people's lips, John, is the shrimp industry, of course, we mentioned earlier, the challenges and their efforts on the marketing side. There's also some concerns now. The ghost of the duties are back, the countervailing duties against shrimp in the U.S. This goes back a long, 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 long time, and it seems like there's kind of always a countervailing duty process that's underway in the United States against shrimp imports. And it looks like there is concern that it's coming again and could hit India, Ecuador. Any sense from the folks that you talk to as to how realistic this might be, whether or not we can expect this?
Yeah, I think everybody is expecting it, to be honest with you. These generally don't fail when they get put up. And I can't even remember what number of anti-dumping duty moves we're in right now, but they've been going on for probably almost 2 decades, right? So I think what I heard was they're going to probably pass. They're probably going to get the government's approval. And then what happens? It's the same old thing. We'll see who gets hit the hardest. And I talked to Nate Torch at Sensi at the show, and he said, I can't worry too much, he said, because we're all going to be in the same boat if it happens. So we've been there before, and we're just going to have to fight our way through. I think what baffles me is how much more money can we give the U.S. domestic shrimp sector in duties and those things that we collect in this process. How much more money can we give? We've given them $500 million over the years collectively, as far as through these dumping duties. How much more do they need? I mean, they're no better off than they were before all this. It's not an industry that is consolidated appropriately. It's not an industry that seems to work together to me. Yet they have the power to disrupt, imports. And on their best day, they can't supply the U.S. market. They can, there's different figures, but it's somewhere between 10% and maybe 20% of the U.S. market could be supplied by them. Well, no. What would that do to the price of shrimp, So I don't know. I find myself really tired of this whole narrative about, the mean foreign countries and their shrimp farmers are ruining our business. I'm like, are they, or are you just not kind of moving along and, learning a new song?
Well, either way, even if these kind of railing duties do go into place, there is not likely to be any major collapse of shrimp ports into the U.S.
No,
market. That's just
no.
not going to happen. It's just too popular of a species. Another species that I'll mention too, because it came up a couple of times with folks. I said earlier, Regal Springs, speaking with their CEO Alois Hofbauer. His view now, he's got a dog in the fight, right? Because they produce tilapia, but he's been very frank about the company's problems, but so I do believe him on this. But his view is that there is kind of some new reawakening of the tilapia market in the US. And I've heard this from a couple other people as well, not just tilapia suppliers, that tilapia has been kind of undersupplied into the US market, especially on the chilled side. It's gotten not a great reputation because of some social media and SEO issues when you start looking into tilapia. So it's been kind of a species that's taken a battering over the past maybe I would say decade, John. But I remember at the GSMC conference, I believe it was, that you had some data that you were presented there that you passed along that showed the name recognition of tilapia is through the roof in the United States. Not so much in Europe, it's just not a well-known fish over there. But here, a lot of Americans know the name tilapia. And so Hofbauer was saying that there's a battle now to be waged between higher quality tilapia and tilapia as a cost fish, and that's not going to be easy. He admitted that you can do everything right in the world, but consumers do tend to behave differently when they step in the store, and they have to make that purchasing decision. As to before, when they can kind of be philosophical about the types of food that they'd like to purchase. So I thought that was really interesting. He believes that there's going to be kind of a return of getting tilapia back on menus, and maybe kind of a reintroduction of tilapia to US consumers and palates that's sort of different than it was before, where there were just huge volumes of frozen tilapia, not a whole lot of attention paid to quality there for a while, especially kind of the heavily glazed fish, issues with flavor, off flavors from pond-raised fish. So I thought that was interesting as well. So maybe some signs of revitalization of the tilapia market in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, the door is open, right? With all the challenges on whitefish given Russia and China, the door is open for a whitefish to step in and kind of get some of that market share. Now, you mentioned the recognition of tilapia on a consumer from a consumer point of view is high. I guess my question would be, is that good recognition or is that bad recognition? So I would say, and just this is just coming off the top of my head after listening to you, I would say this is probably a great fish to use the new marketing tactics that we talked about earlier and reach those new demographics. I would say this is a fish to really that could really do that. But quality is job one. I've gotten tilapia that was muddy, and it is rough. It's really rough. I've gotten tilapia that's wonderful, where I see most of it used these days is in tacos, which is cool, it makes sense, but it may just be the fish to kind of use to see if we can extend ourselves to that new demographic and use the things they use to get their information on what things they're going to buy. So I don't know. I don't know. I hope it kind of has a resurgence. It's certainly a good fish for the market, but it's going to take a little bit of work, I think.
Well, let's end with the king of the seafood counter. So there were no signs whatsoever that salmon is slowing down, despite the high prices. There were massive displays of new products, plenty of smoked salmon companies. All the major salmon farming companies had big booths with new products and plenty of smiles on their faces, even with the challenges of social license and fish health that they're dealing with. The companies are still doing great. All of the salmon farming companies, Chileans, Norwegians, Faroese, you name it, they all had a lot of innovations to showcase. I think it's all about them making the high price point of salmon more palatable through new value-added products. Also, kind of interesting was how salmon was being marketed. Now, MUVI, it's the world's largest salmon farming organization. And this is an important caveat because the marketing campaign that they are rolling out to consumers was showcased at our seafood leadership event. So MUVI was a sponsor of our event. I want to make sure that I mention that. However, the campaign that they showed was interesting. The reason I think it was interesting is it was not shying away from how fish was grown. And that's kind of unique, is that most of aquaculture, anyway, has not really highlighted how it's grown, where it's grown, the people growing it. Now, in Norway, there's been some efforts to kind of promote general promotion of the sector. But in terms of to consumers, actually highlighting how the fish gets to the plate, very, very standard practice with fishing, very standard practice, whether it's the Gorton Fisherman or Captain Birdseye or pictures of, trawlers out in the Alaskan waters, that's been an old trope that's been used forever. Not so much for aquaculture. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And it did seem that in general, there's a bit of a shift among salmon farmers recognizing that that people element is something that's actually that they will want to leverage in how they present their products. I don't know if that struck you, John, as something that you saw in the booths or that you found interesting.
Yeah, I did notice that, and I think it goes to this whole broader question of the challenges they're having to gain quote unquote social license in some of the countries they operate, in most of the countries they operate. The general public wants to support something that they believe is sustainable and clean and good for their country, good for their environment, blah 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 blah. And that's been a little tough lately, given high levels of mortality and fish welfare concerns and stuff like that. So the ability to kind of just squeeze away from that a little bit and show, that this is a job creator, these are your neighbors who are working here, that type of approach. I like it. I like it. I mean, it just baffles me how strong salmon is. It's like I think there's a saying, something along the lines, liquor is recession proof, and meaning, it doesn't matter how expensive it gets or how bad the times are, you're still buying your bourbon or whatever the case may be. Salmon, it just proved it was recession proof. It absolutely proved it last year. And so I don't see any end in sight for it. I mean, I'm afraid we'll have one thing in the seafood case after a while and just be wall to wall salmon. But it's a strong product, and probably what we should do is deconstruct how they got here, because it may provide really, really valuable lessons for other species.
I have some great ideas on how we can do that. So stay tuned, readers and listeners, because there are a lot of stories out there to dig into about how we got here. Because you're right, John. There are lessons that can be learned. So one last thing before we go to, we released our Power 100 again for 2024. It is always so much fun to come up with these names, discuss, debate, figure out who's number 30 versus number 50. And all the reactions. Thank you, everybody, for emails, comments, questions. It makes us very happy when we hear that you have when you have rationale for why somebody that wasn't on the list should have been on the list. Makes us happy when those of you out there reading say, "Hey, why wasn't I on the list?" It's great. Every year we have to make tough decisions. And remember, you can send us an email anytime and say, "Hey, next year, pay attention to this person. Here's why." We'd love to hear that because, it could factor in. We have to look at a broad swath of the industry, so it is a challenge. We have to look at the types of years they had, and where they moved in their organizations, what their organizations accomplished, but. Always a lot of fun, and I think although putting it together is a lot of work and takes a lot of time, we're always happy to do it because we feel like it's important. We feel it's important to recognize who it is that influences this industry, and the reactions are always fun and instructive.
Well, but hold on now. Once again, I was left off the list. I'm not complaining. Yes, I am. But I'll send you an email, and let you know I'm not entirely happy about it. But hey, that's the way it goes. No, just kidding. But no, it's a great list, and everybody on there seemed, the people I talked to who were on there were very pleased, and they deserve it. And I love that we do this. I think it's one of the more rewarding parts of the year when we have to put this together, and it takes a little bit of work, but it's well worth it.
Well, if anybody out there thinks John belongs on the list, send me an email. I'll tally up the votes. And if there's anybody else beyond his children, I'll be shocked. But we'll take it into account.
Get at least six. That's all.
Well, thanks, everybody. Hey, remember, you can go to intrafish.com and find us there 24/7. You can sign up for our newsletters. If you're a subscriber, you can sign up for our keyword alerts. Those are fantastic because you can track any subject that you want. So if you do want to hear just from John Fiorillo, or you want to get notified every time he publishes a story or a commentary, you can get an alert for John Fiorillo's name, etc. Any subject, topic, person that you can think of. And that could maybe help keep your inbox a little bit cleaner while you can still make sure to get news immediately. And it's even better when you download the app because that'll push directly to your phone. Thanks again for joining us, folks. We'll talk to you next week.